I next met with Dr. Ann So, and to begin, we chatted about clinical research in mesothelioma.
This is a tough tumor to treat. The patients very often are sick when they first present. They're more likely to be hypercoagulable and have problems with DVT-PEs. And so the community oncologists often find these challenging patients. I do want to put out there that there definitely is hope. We have seen significant benefit by enrollment onto clinical trials for these patients. I recommend that every patient at MD Anderson that's seen try to get onto one of the clinical studies with these new novel agents. Generally, we see that these patients, very frequently, they haven't been smokers. The only thing is, you know, patients who have been in the military in the past and were exposed because they were on submarines, naval ships, or pipe fitting, they do have a smoking history associated. But oftentimes the comorbidities come from the actual disease because it puts a strain on the lungs, so they're very short-winded. If they have any underlying COPD, that makes it worse for their dyspnea on exertion and shortness of breath. Also, it puts strain on the heart. So if they have any underlying coronary artery disease, that can be problematic. They can have arrhythmias. They also, as I mentioned, are hypercoagulable. So if you get a PE on top of the current shortness of breath because of the disease, it can be very tough to get these patients in good enough shape to get treatment.
How many new cases are there a year in the United States?
The estimate is 2,500 to 3,000 in the United States alone, 5,000 in Western Europe. Certainly, we don't have a good incidence in Central and South America, but we do know that they are having a rash of mesothelioma cases. Unfortunately, there's no national collection in terms of incidence because their governments don't promote that. So we do see a lot of patients that travel internationally to us from those areas.
Any comments about palliative therapy in this situation? What are some of the common issues? Do you approach them any differently, for example, pleural fusions?
So there was a recent article done by Rintoul et al. Published in Lancet, where he specifically looked at talc pleuridesis versus doing a partial pleurectomy. And what they showed is that there was no survival benefit between the two, but it seemed that quality of life was better with the partial pleurectomy at certain months that they looked at in terms of quality of life. My sense of that is, though, that patients get very good palliative benefit from the talc pleuridesis, and if you can control their disease with systemic agents, they generally do very well overall. Doing a partial pleurectomy doesn't make a lot of sense to me because there's a lot of recovery time for the patients after. You achieve pretty much the same thing with the talc pleuridesis and systemic chemotherapy.
So how do you think through initial treatment options and particularly the issue of local versus systemic therapy?
So our surgeons at MD Anderson are very focused on doing mesothelioma surgery. So there's two types of surgeries they can offer. The first is something called an extrapleural pneumonectomy. That is the one procedure that here in the United States we believe is curative intent for mesothelioma. It is a massive surgery. Out of every 100 patients, probably only 20 are candidates. And that's where they basically remove the visceral and parietal pleura. They take out the affected lung. They take out part of the diaphragm, part of the pericardium, and then they reconstruct everything. They also do a mediastinal nodal dissection as well. Now, again, you have to be very strong to tolerate this, and in general, they're not going to do this in a patient who has sarcomatoid mesothelioma. They will not do this in a patient who has mediastinal involvement of mesothelioma, because those patients tend to have a very poor outcome afterwards. The second procedure that's done in the United States for definitive intent potentially is something called a pleurectomy decortication. Now, in this is not considered an R0 resection because you are leaving microscopic disease behind, potentially even microscopic disease. So what this is you leave the lung intact, but you basically go in and just peel off the tumor and the pleura throughout the chest. And then you may or may not do a mediastinal nodal dissection here. Now, in the past, because you can't radiate the lung after this procedure, because the lung is intact, it's often thought to be purely palliative. But there are now innovative radiation therapy techniques where they can go in and just radiate the high-risk areas where there was significant tumor involvement. And there have been documented cases now where with this procedure, there are patients with long-term survival outcomes that are disease-free.
So it kind of sounds like something that would not be that easy to get even a healthy person through. What do you see in terms of recovery from these procedures?
So usually from an extrapleural pneumonectomy, they need probably about 9 days in the hospital, roughly, and then they'll be out. Now, usually after an extrapleural pneumonectomy, because all the contents are out and we're going for cure, they have to then get through hemithoracic radiation. And that could be done with external beam or intensity modulated radiotherapy, but either which way, it should be done in an experienced mesothelioma center. Now, this usually takes about 6 to 7 weeks afterwards. And then probably about 4 to 6 weeks after that, we're looking at giving them adjuvant chemotherapy if they didn't get it already up front as neoadjuvant. So it's a pretty lengthy course.
Which chemotherapy?
Cisplatin pemetrexed. We use the same principles as in lung cancer, where we recommend cisplatin instead of carboplatin for definitive intent.
So how long does it take these patients to get back to, you know, normal if they do, and how many of them don't, you know, really have serious problems?
Yeah, after an extrapleural pneumonectomy, again, these patients are highly selected ahead of time. So generally, these patients, maybe 8 months after all their treatment is completed, will get back to a normal life. In the case of a pleurectomy decortication, the recovery time is faster, there's less time in the hospital, they have both lungs intact, they might get some high-risk area adjuvant radiation therapy, and then chemo, so the recovery time is less for that.
So a couple of kind of related questions. What's the typical survival of a patient as you just described?
When we approach curative intent, the clinical trials with trimodality therapy to date still put the median overall survival between 17 to 25 months.
And in terms of the biology of this disease, I don't know. I kind of, when I think about it, maybe it's back from med school days, I always thought about it in terms of not very highly proliferating, a lot of sort of fibrous stroma. What do we know about the biology and the interaction between tumor cells and stroma?
Mm-hmm. That is a fantastic question that needs a lot more research than what we have. So we do know that there is significant interaction with the tumor stroma, the PDGFR pathway being one of them, by stimulating the tumor-associated endothelial cells. This is definitely a target for therapy, but unfortunately, there's not a lot of research funding that we have for mesothelioma. So the basic science biology research is definitely lagging behind other tumor types.
Any predictions about where you think we might be heading over the next 5 or 10, where we might be? Do you see, you know, sort of any hope that we can maybe make some major inroads with this disease?
I definitely do. I think the immunotherapy agents are definitely critical in mesothelioma. Mesothelioma is a very immunogenic tumor. We know that it has an overexpression of PD-L1. And we often see that in the worst variant, the sarcomatoid tumors of mesothelioma. So I think incorporation of the PD-L1 inhibitors is critical. We're currently in the process of developing a SWOG study in the neoadjuvant setting with an anti-PD-L1 inhibitor with chemo neoadjuvant and then maintenance immunotherapy after. So I'm hoping that we improve median overall survival for our potential curative intent patients. And then certainly these agents are being looked at in the metastatic unresectable setting too with chemotherapy.
Have any responses been observed to any anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 agents?
So as of today, it's mostly been anecdotal because we don't have a trial open yet that's utilized those agents. But there have been, anecdotally in small numbers.
So let's move on to the more common pulmonary oncology issues in non-small cell lung cancer, specifically metastatic disease. And you brought in some cases from your practice. How about your 40-year-old lady?
So she was a unfortunate 40-year-old who was on her honeymoon, and she developed a headache and went into an emergency room in San Diego, and unfortunately was found to have a large brain mass. She also had several satellite nodules in her brain, and so they initiated her immediately on whole brain radiation therapy. Now, she was found on her initial staging to have multiple pulmonary metastases and also bone metastases throughout her spine. But she transferred her care over immediately after the whole brain radiation to us. We did do a biopsy and showed that she was EGFR mutation, exon 19, and she was on erlotinib for close to a year and a half with an excellent, almost complete response, doing very well.
How did she do in the erlotinib, incidentally?
Very well, actually. She only had, at best, grade 2 skin rash, which was waxing and waning, but she was able to control it with the clindamycin tea gel ointment, intermittent use of doxycycline as well, or minocycline, and then, you know, she used makeup. So she didn't seem to have too much difficulty with that. No diarrhea, actually, which was fortunate.
She was a non-smoker?
Non-smoker.
How did she do after the brain radiation, both symptomatically as well as on imaging?
So she was young, and so I think she tolerated the whole brain radiation very well. Although, as with many of our patients, they do report they're more forgetful afterwards. Her cognitive skills might have been slightly dulled, but not significantly in any way that affected her job or what she was doing on a daily basis.
So before we continue on with her course, just to take a deep breath and say, what was it like to see her? I mean, to have somebody on their honeymoon be diagnosed with metastatic disease to the brain. I mean, oncologists are used to dealing with difficult situations, but I'm particularly curious what was going on with her and her husband.
It was so hard for them. They were at the beginning of a life together and had to deal with this. It was extremely traumatic. Certainly, we are unfortunately seeing many more cases like this, I think partially because we are a referral center, but we tend to see patients now in their 40s coming in with widely metastatic non-small cell lung cancer.
So she's having a good response to erlotinib and on it for a year and a half. Then what happened?
So then she developed disease progression globally. Her bone metastases, which had completely resolved, came back in force. She had liver metastases that were new. The pulmonary nodules returned. Because she was in severe pain, we went immediately to palliative radiation treatment. And I actually did continue the erlotinib during that time. I do think it is safe to give erlotinib during palliative radiation treatment to the spine and to other areas of the body. We recently had a phase 2 trial also done by Jim Welsh in our radiation oncology group looking at the safety of erlotinib with whole brain radiation, and he did not show that there was any significant long-term toxicities associated with it, and the acute toxicities appear to be minimal. And so we do think that it's very safe to do that. I did re-biopsy her because my concern was that she might have a T790 mutation, a resistance mutation. But what I found instead was that she had transformed to small cell lung cancer.
Yeah, that was quite dramatic. How often do you see that?
So in Lisha Sequest's translational medicine paper, she reports the incidence was 14% in the cohort of patients that they studied. I do think that this is a very rare phenomenon, and I would probably rate that it's probably less than that, but it should certainly be in our differential. Whenever we have a patient who's on an EGFR TKI who has a mutation that has rapid global growth of their disease.
I was going to ask you whether, you know, this situation of a patient who starts out, has a good response to an EGFR TKI and then progresses, obviously happens all the time, unfortunately. In general, do you consider re-biopsy kind of standard in that situation?
I do. I do for the EGFR mutants and also for my EML4 ALK patients.
And what's your vision? I mean, we see this actually in prostate cancer also, where all of a sudden small cell shows up. And there it's even harder to understand, at least for me. What's your vision pathophysiologically about what's going on? Is it really a transformation?
I have no idea.
Do you think it's like maybe there were two clones and you suppressed one? I mean, it just seems pretty bizarre.
I think that in time, if we can get enough specimens to do genetic profiling on the small cell lung cancer, we might have more of an idea of how this arose. Because if they still carry the EGFR mutation, the sensitive one, that might be crucial. Or if they do and then they have a second driver mutation that induces the small cell, then we might have a better understanding. Now, I have heard anecdotally that if they transform to small cell and you give them a small cell regimen, such as platinum etoposide, that sometimes you can bulk reduce the disease enough and control the small cell enough that you can establish another progression-free survival period and you could go back to erlotinib. Now, in her case, we were unable to do that. She had an initial response to her chemotherapy with platinum etoposide, but after 4 cycles of therapy, her disease exploded again, and we were just unable to control it. But certainly, in time, my hope is that when we have more cases like this, we'll understand the biology of the small cell better.
Now, in terms of the small cell diagnosis here, was the mutation in the small cell?
So when I went to profile her tumor, it was not there. in the small cell.
That's kind of what I would have guessed, which obviously she didn't get in repeat therapy. But I'm sure everybody who was listening to this case, when you got to the point that she was progressing at a year and a half, were expecting the biopsy to show, you know, that she still had the disease with the EGFR mutation. Can you talk about how you handle that situation? That's maybe one of the most controversial issues in oncology, what the options are and how you think through what to do when somebody progresses after erlotinib.
Mm-hmm. So if they have not progressed to small cell or transformed, and if they just come back with their re-biopsy as either T790M, or let's say they still have their EGFR mutation and there's no other driver that you can discern to put them into a clinical trial, you have a couple options. If they are what we call oligoprogressors, meaning that there's only one or two sites that are progressing, we usually radiate or do definitive local control and continue on erlotinib, or in this case now, we have afatinib available frontline in our mutants. But if they have more of a mixed picture where a large amount of their disease is growing or globally everything is slowly growing, you do have to consider switching therapy. Now, in the past, we've had to look towards chemotherapy. So you have the option of combining chemotherapy with erlotinib, or you could intercalate the erlotinib with the chemotherapy. And the reason for that is there's always been a hypothesis that the EGFR TKIs should not be given together with chemo, because the EGFR TKIs usually stabilize the cancer cell cycle between the G1S checkpoint in the cell cycle. And chemo works best when the cell is cycling through mitosis. So the thought was, hypothetically, there's an antagonistic effect, so we shouldn't be giving the two together. So in Asia, primarily in the FASTAC trials, they were intercalating the EGFR TKIs with chemo. So for instance, you give chemo on days one, and you hold the erlotinib for 4 days after, and then you give erlotinib for the rest of the cycle, and then you hold it a couple of days before you give the next treatment. And so that way you prevent that hypothetical antagonism. So that's two of the ways that you could approach it. The third way, which I've done more frequently, is to stop the EGFR TKI, give systemic chemotherapy, and then resume the EGFR TKI like a maintenance regimen after 4 cycles of treatment when you've bulk reduced the disease again and reestablished control.
Any comments about, you mentioned afatinib. First of all, do you ever use afatinib after erlotinib? Do you ever use it upfront instead of erlotinib?
So that is the million-dollar question about how are we going to be doing in the frontline setting all of these new EGFR TKIs, not just the second generation of afatinib, but also the ones coming, the CO-1686 and AZD-9291. Now, right now, afatinib is only FDA approved for the frontline setting for EGFR mutation patients. So your options for your mutants that are sensitive are going to be erlotinib versus afatinib frontline. There's been some data presented at ASCO suggesting that afatinib seems to work in the deletion exon 19 patients and not so well in the L858 mutants. So that's food for thought for deciding in the frontline setting which agent you want to use. Now, quality of life is always important. Afatinib does have a little bit more diarrhea. It does have a little bit more of the rash, but it is an irreversible inhibitor. And so the thought is that it might be more potent for your EGFR deletion exon 19s.
Have you ever used it upfront instead of erlotinib? And if not, are there any situations where you would?
I have in a deletion exon 19.
Interesting. What about afatinib cetuximab?
So there is a SWOG study that is about to be open soon, I believe, that's looking at afatinib cetuximab for the T790 mutants. So they would have had to have failed on an EGFR TKI upfront, and then this combination would be looking at the mutant-resistant population. And so in the resistant EGFR mutants, although I talked about doing chemotherapy options now, our future is very promising, particularly with the CO-1686 and the AZD-9291, because these two agents are the third generation inhibitors to EGFR. And the thought is that they will target the mutated EGFR and not affect the EGFR wild type. So the hope is that there'll be much less skin rash and diarrhea, which is what usually plagues our patients who have to have the EGFR inhibition.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? You mentioned Lisha Sequist, and she presented some data on the CO-1686 compound that I thought was pretty interesting, both in terms of efficacy and toxicity. Do you see objective responses in people who've progressed on, you know, other EGFR TKI like erlotinib?
They certainly have. I think the question will not be whether or not they'll get FDA approval. Both of those two agents are on the pathway for breakthrough FDA indication. And so they most certainly will become part of our armamentarium for treatment in these patients. The question will be, how do we sequence all of these? And what is the optimal pathway of sequencing? Do we begin first with the third generation EGFR TKIs? Or should we be starting off with our reversible EGFR TKIs and then build up from there? And that's going to be a question we'll have to answer.
In terms of these two third generation agents, at this point, any way to differentiate them?
It's still a little too early to tell. The rumors on the ground are that the AZD9291 might have a little bit more diarrhea than the CO1686, but they're still too early. We need more patients on these studies to really be able to discern that for sure.
One of the things that Dr. Sequist presented that I thought was really cool was this issue of the T790 mutation and the responses that are seen there. Can you explain what that mutation is and what this means?
Yes. Yeah, so the T790 is a resistance mutation. It essentially changes a codon, which affects one amino acid, which affects the protein structure, and it completely alters the binding pocket in the ATP kinase binding region of the EGFR so that they no longer bind to the reversible EGFR inhibitors to date, the erlotinib and gefitinib. And the thought is that with these other second and third generation inhibitors, if you get irreversible binding to the receptor, that might have the benefit of knocking out that pathway. And then certainly these third generation inhibitors, which go at this from a different area of the receptor, that they may potentially have benefit by knocking out the pathway this way.
What do we know about toxicity? I had also heard this thing about these people don't seem to have what you expect in terms of diarrhea and rash, and really exciting in terms of maybe if these things ever move into the adjuvant setting, which I want to ask you about. But what kinds of problems, if any, have been seen with these drugs?
So mostly GI. So as with any, I think, oral agent, nausea is always a complication. GI complaints, you always have to worry about liver enzyme function too. So that is always a concern for these oral agents. The rash is definitely less, according to all of the preliminary studies, because they theoretically do not target the EGFR wild type. And also the diarrhea is markedly less.
So I'm going to ask you in a second, in terms of your priority, what you'd want to see or what you'd do if you were in this situation, and where these getting on a trial of one of these agents, and hopefully, as you say, maybe just getting the drug once they get approved. But I want to ask you also about afatinib cetuximab as a non-protocol option. Is that something that you ever do?
It is not something that I do off study, because I think that we do need more data. And so the SWOG trial will hopefully be open soon for our T790 mutants. If I had a patient and I had to choose between a third generation EGFR inhibitor trial and the afatinib cetuximab trial, strictly because of toxicity reasons, I would probably want to veer more towards the third generation EGFR inhibitors.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know if you've seen patients who've gotten that combination, but you would expect, and I think what we've heard is pretty serious dermatotoxicity.
More skin rash, more diarrhea, GI toxicity effects.
How about your other patient, the 45-year-old man?
So this was a gentleman who was at an outside facility, and he was in perfect health, and then he had a headache, and his wife noticed he had facial paralysis. So when he was seen in the local ER, his head CT scan showed a mass, and so he got a brain MRI, which showed two brain lesions. So he received stereotactic radiation and then transferred his care over to us. His initial staging workup demonstrated lung primary, mediastinal lymph nodes. He had some bilateral pulmonary mets. And a biopsy demonstrated that he was adenocarcinoma EML4 ALK positive. So he received the crizotinib and did well with almost complete resolution of all of his systemic disease for about 8 months. And during that time, he had received one brain MRI, which showed that he had good control of his brain disease. But then he started having symptoms of lightheadedness, headache. He had some more confusion. He was having difficulty remembering what he did that day. And so a brain MRI demonstrated two new brain lesions. So he received additional stereotactic radiation to these two lesions, and we continued the crizotinib. And he's probably close to 9 months out now since the new brain metastases on the crizotinib.
So this case also brings up the issue, again, we were talking about with EGFR, but with ALK in terms of next generation agents, and we have ceritinib now approved. What about second line therapy with one of these agents, or at some point, where do you see that fitting in this man's case?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was a consideration that I thought about when he developed his new brain lesions. But we do know that you can reestablish second progression-free survival periods. So that's why we proceeded with continuing crizotinib and then just radiating those two lesions. But certainly we know ceritinib has the benefit of crossing the blood-brain barrier, and it will provide benefit to brain lesions in our patients that we can no longer just treat definitively locally. And so ceritinib will be my second choice in this patient when he does develop progression either systemically or if he progresses in the brain again, which we find in these ALK patients happens very frequently, that will definitely be my choice to go to. Now, there are several other third-generation ALK inhibitors coming out down the pipeline. Alectinib is certainly making huge waves out in Asia. The thought is that that may be a very well-tolerated agent. There's also the AP26113 agent. Those are all happening, but certainly I believe alectinib is escalating very quickly towards FDA approval. And so we'll be watching out for that agent. Again, we might be caught in a situation like the EGFR inhibitors where we have to figure out what is the optimal sequencing of all of these ALK inhibitors.
And of course, the obvious question is, should they be used before crizotinib? What's the thinking there?
Oh, that is the million-dollar question with these inhibitors. The thought, again, is, are you a believer that you should use your big gun first, or are you more focused and then, you know, escalate up to the larger gun? And so the ceritinib and the third generation ALK inhibitors all do cross the blood-brain barrier. So I do see that that is an advantage over crizotinib. But do we really necessarily need that? And are we potentially inducing earlier resistance mechanisms by using the larger gun first? And those are questions that are unknown as of yet. I do think that there is a comparative study out in Asia of crizotinib versus alectinib. So we may get some information there. And so that will be of significant interest, of course.
What about toxicity and side effects with these new agents? What are they and how do they compare to crizotinib?
So the ceritinib starts off at the 750 milligram dose, but in the New England Journal of Medicine paper by Shah et al., we saw that there was like a 62% dose reduction rate down to 600. They didn't seem to see a very significant difference in terms of efficacy at the 600 milligram dose, but that remains to be seen. So the ceritinib definitely, that is a challenge with that agent. I believe it's mostly GI toxicities that induce that. Certainly elevation of liver function tests, you have no choice but to dose reduce, but also the nausea and, you know, GI complaints that go with that. The crizotinib does tend to also have a bit more of the visual disturbances, I think, than the second generation ALK inhibitors. But again, it's very patient dependent. I have had, now that we've treated a lot more patients, I have had GI dysmotility and peripheral edema that occurs with the crizotinib. And so we will have to see if that also is a problem with the second generation ALK inhibitors. The alectinib, we don't have a lot of experience with that here in the United States, but out in the Asia trials, if you do a cross comparison, the alectinib does seem to be reportedly more well tolerated than the ceritinib and the crizotinib. But again, until we have it in our population in larger numbers, I think that that's too preliminary to make that call.
So this man's been on crizotinib a lot. How does he do on crizotinib? Did he have the visual problems?
He actually didn't really have the visual problems. He did have some nausea initially, but I don't know, again, how much of that was related to his brain disease as well and the treatments to his brain. He had slight pedal edema, and he also had hypogonadism. He had decreased testosterone. So those were his main issues.